The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this week's edition of Century, we'll hear part two of my conversation with Dr. Tim Piankowski, a researcher and lecturer at Griffith University in Queensland, Australia, who's doing some great work involving harm reduction and the community of people who use image and performance-enhancing drugs. But first, Haven Wheelock, MPH, is the Harm Reduction Services Manager at Portland area nonprofit Outside In, and is also one of the co-authors of a research article published September 27th in the journal JAMA Psychiatry entitled One Year Association of Drug Possession Law Change with Fatal Drug Overdose in Oregon and Washington.
The intention of us looking into this is there's a lot on both the pro-decrim side and the anti-decrim side. There's been a lot of rhetoric around what happens to overdose rates when you decriminalize possession of drugs, as we did in Oregon. So we really wanted to look at what impact does this policy have? We were curious if it increased overdose, decreased overdose, did nothing to overdose. So we really wanted to create a study and look at what is happening with a genuine question mark, right? It was intentionally we want to know, it's important to know whether or not policies like this do end up having an impact and what that impact is. So we looked at the first year's worth of data, which is all we could actually get, to really evaluate whether or not both Oregon and Washington, who both had decriminalized possession of small amounts of drugs in different ways, if it did have an impact in rates of overdose for those states. And the answer was it didn't. When we look at the raw numbers, right, and when we look at data, to say that overdoses have not gone up in our states is not true. We have seen an increase in overdose in Oregon and Washington. However, what this paper shows and what really demonstrated is that it didn't go up more than we would have expected it to without decrim. And so there were other factors in play that resulted in this increase, namely that fentanyl entered our drug supply at the same time. On the West Coast, fentanyl really wasn't a driver in overdose death up until about 2020, 2021. And so the policy of decrim wasn't the driving factor in the increases we are seeing. And Oregon and Washington did not have increases in overdose death rates that are different from other states throughout the country, which to someone on the ground and someone working in harm reduction, someone who is engaged nationally around what is happening around this overdose crisis, it's not surprising to me that it's not different. As much as I'm so excited that this study is out there and that we can point to it when people are decrim caused an increase in overdose, being able to be actually it didn't, feels really good. But as somebody who's been in the thick of it for a very long time, I'm not surprised to find this out, right? If overdose rates are going up in California, in Colorado, in Montana, then it can't be decrim that is causing this issue.
Haven, any closing thoughts for the listeners?
Listen to the science, friends. The media wants to talk about drugs and decriminalization and cities like Portland in a way that is not reflective of the beauty and the amazing resilience that we see in our communities and on our streets. And poverty porn is great clickbait, but it is not actually what we see in our beautiful city. And folks who are using drugs are smart and resilient and humans that deserve better than what the national media has been portraying them as in our current world.
Avon, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Have a wonderful day.
That was part of my conversation with Haven Wheelock, MPH, Harm Reduction Services Manager at Portland area nonprofit Outside In, and one of the co-authors of a research article published September 27th in the journal JAMA Psychiatry entitled One Year Association of Drug Possession Law Change with Fatal Drug Overdose in Oregon and Washington. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's hear some of my conversation with Dr. Tim Piotrkowski. We're talking harm reduction and image and performance-enhancing drugs. We had part one last week. Here's part two. Novel psychoactive substances, novel psychoactive drugs, this is the fact it's an illegal market means people are always trying to find a way of getting something that's stronger and cheaper, or at least more profitable. Does that kind of thing happen in the steroid market, or the performance image and performance-enhancing drug market? Sorry.
Yeah, great question. So, I recently did a piece around this in that was published in International Journal of Drug Policy, and we've in Queensland here we've got drug checking coming in as a government initiative. Now, Canberra was the first. Obviously, they have a service set up for that, and Queensland has decided that they're going to follow suit and be second. Excellent decision. So, I interviewed a number of steroid consumers, they use other iPads as well, but ask them about what a service design would look like, what a delivery would look like, why it's important, those sorts of things. And yeah, there's a high, the literature will tell us that there's a high proportion of counterfeit products available. There's a high proportion. So underdose steroids, overdose steroids, replacement of particular, you know, if you're after and this is a great point to raise. So for women, a lot of women will reach for primobolan, so metanolone, because they androgenic side effects are low, so that virilization, things like that, quite low. Now, primobolan is anecdotally the most counterfeit steroid. The raw powder costs significantly more, and I did a recent paper on manufacture and steroid manufacture, interviewed a manufacturer, and it costs significantly more, and therefore there's some people that might take advantage of that and replace that, as with any illicit market where prohibition is present, right? So in those instances, women are particularly at risk of harm, for example, if they're asking for oxandrolone, so Anava, or primobolan, which is the drugs, again, from some of the work that I've done interviewing these women, the drugs that they'll reach for. And so if it's replaced with, for example, trenbolone, although it's more commonly replaced with testosterone or something like that, then they are taking something that they didn't intend to take that has a higher propensity for androgenic side effects. And therefore, you know, for them, it's really, I've got a piece under review around this now, it's life-changing, because, it's, you know, fertility could be immediate, other psychosocial issues because of hair growth, things like that, coming on a lot quicker, irreversible changes, right? So obviously, super important initiative, drug checking. Not that men don't experience harms as well. You know, there's other things that end up in the product. So excipients, you know, carrier oils that aren't ideal, perhaps presence of heavy metals, things like that, that probably aren't fantastic to be injecting regularly. And because in Australia particularly, hormone replacement therapy, testosterone replacement is quite difficult to, it's quite a convoluted process. Lots of people turn to the underground market. And so like we were saying, there's no guarantee, and there's harms that come out of that. Obviously, I'm on board with the drug checking initiative. I actually have a bit of an intervention underway. We're just waiting for ethics clearance, where we're going to look at people dropping off, us testing, and then feeding those results back out into the community and seeing what that does to the market. I'll flag as well, Doug, that because public initiatives have been so thin for this consumer group in Australia, that they've taken matters into their own hands and continue to do so. and internationally as well, really. But on online forums, there are people that are testing underground products. So they'll get together, buy a few vials, test them using, there's a few services out there that will do a test for them, and then publishing those results online so that consumers can see which labs are performing, which labs are not performing very well. And that's a pretty cool harm reduction initiative, I think. The other thing we've got in Australia is PED test. PED test is a reagent testing kit for iPad consumers, and they can order these, check using the dyes, the strength, whether the compound is what's listed. And that's been, again, very recent, but sorely needed initiative. And they've got a good, strong following on social media, but I think there's definitely some positive feedback there from the community.
That's terrific. That's one. I mean, we have friends involved in harm reduction who are doing drug checking, drug consumer safety, for heaven's sake. You got to know, my friend has a saying, and it's so true. You know, thanks to Prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. I mean, it's the strength, purity, and all the rest. It's just wow. So okay, so online forums, and obviously the internet's a place where people are getting information about these. But what impact is the internet having? I mean, you've got these so-called influencers on social media. I sound like a cranky old man for whom middle age is a distant memory, and that's because I am what I am. So, but what impact are these so-called influencers on social media having in regard to use of performance and image enhancing drugs?
Yeah, look, so I've had a few colleagues do some work on this, and so have I. There's definitely, it's double-edged, right? So there, and I'll speak to both sides of this. So it's definitely double-edged. That is that there's some influencers out there that are promoting products that may or may not work. They're promoting, the most recent one is the 30-day trend challenge on TikTok, or it's the one that comes to my memory first, where there's people very, very much under 25 who are reaching for trend, which we've just spoken about, and using that drug, reaching for it very early, but aren't professional bodybuilders, powerlifters, anything like that. And so, you know, there's horrendous effects coming about from that. Now, I think recently a colleague of mine and myself published a piece around Liver King. Now, that's a good example of a social media influencer, micro celebrity, you could call it, that propagated an idea and an ideal that wasn't necessarily realistic, that couldn't be achieved naturally. And so really left everybody in a bit of dissonance, or, you know, trying to achieve something that wasn't necessarily possible. So the lies, right? And there's personally, I use, you know, everybody has the option to use what they want to enhance or otherwise. They take that risk. But it's a little bit of a gray area when people are doing that and claiming what's called in the social media circles fake natty. So, and there's a lot of joke pages that have come out, joke social media pages and profiles that have come out about this. 50% natty is very, very funny, a very interesting take on it, and good humor. So I think saying that you are natural and in fact taking a number of iPads is probably a dangerous message to send and could be very confusing for younger men and women who might think, you know, and I'm oversimplifying here, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? I'm eating healthy, I'm training, I'm doing all these things, I'm following these, you know, workout programs, and I don't look like her or him or them or whoever it is. It'll be a little bit distressing. On the other, so that's one side of the picture. On the other hand, and I've got a project with some colleagues from UK as well as here in Australia looking at this, anabolic coaching or drug coaching phenomenon. So there are mentors, there are peers in the community, and there are mentors that have stepped up into the positions where they're not just coaching people around their exercise or diet or natural supplementation, so, you know, things like protein or creatine or pre-workout, things like that, but also coaching people around how to use these drugs. And this comes predominantly from a place of, at least the preliminary data is telling us, comes from a place of lived experience. So this idea of doing and sharing and building what's called, or what we're terming, chemical capital. So this idea that I build up my knowledge through doing, making mistakes. But then, you know, of course, there's a monetary aspect there, but they are in essence promoting harm reduction. They recognize, a lot of the coaches that we interviewed, or drug iPad coaches we interviewed, were very much negotiating safety in the community. It was this act of harm reduction through, you know, a common saying was less is more, because using more might, for example, with, and I'll use trend because it's an easy one, using more might lead to your mind straying in different directions and not staying on the training and not eating and not, you know, doing the things that you're meant to be doing. And so from that aspect, very positive influencer, micro-celebrity, peer modeling.
Interesting. So then actually, what you're talking about, peer mentors, that leads me to my next question. In recovery and in harm reduction, peer mentors are invaluable. They play a really major role. What is peer mentoring like within the community of people who use performance and image-enhancing drugs?
It's huge because... and. Not just here in Australia, but it's through forums, through word of mouth, through everything. Because I think, again, we have sort of put this in an illegal category and we've put it to the side. It is seen as cheating in tested sports. It is seen as, you know, this idea of perhaps not doing the right thing. And then that anti-doping framework, that anti, you know, that framework of legality have sort of stacked on top of each other and propagated into, you know, our sociocultural fabric to the point where, you know, don't do steroids. It's naughty and it's bad. And so because of that, it's pushed things further underground, pushed them away from medical supervision. Particularly in Australia, GPs shy away from these discussions, according to themselves and consumers. So I've interviewed both. And they're left with very, very little to go off except for each other. So what do you do? You experiment, and then it's this process of doing and sharing, except that I guess it's had to happen organically where some peers have made the mistakes and not only acquired this lived experience, but compared and consulted that with the medical literature available, or the peer-reviewed academic literature available, where, you know, we can make inferences from animal models or in vitro tissue studies, things like that, where there's some drugs or some compounds that are probably safer than others. There's some dosages that we can see have been used and the effects of that use. And so piecing all of this information together has sort of created a little bit of an evidence base. But that evidence base, you know, needs to come from the right person or the right place. And so there's this idea of, you know, cultural, social, cultural and body capital, really. Person needs to look like they've done things or have done things in the past that are matching with what they say. The person needs to be known, respected in the community for that message to be transmuted appropriately or to actually hit the target. And then they need to be, I guess, respected and known for delivering appropriate service or appropriate messages. So a combination of looking the part, being well known and then having a track record. And so this happens organically on forums, happens organically on social media, happens organically in gym environments in person. And I think that's been predominantly the way that harm reduction has been promoted through the community. And as well, you know, I will add that there's people promoting the wrong messages as well, not necessarily because of any malicious intent or reason, but just because of, as we said, a lack of resourcing, education, and openness.
You mentioned harm reduction. Now, what should be the role of harm reduction and of harm reduction service providers in respect to the community of people who use performance and image enhancing drugs?
Yeah, no, and from the research I've done, 100%, and needle service providers are seen as a good and safe place. They're trusted, and part of that's because, you know, providing a free service to the community for their sharps. Of course, they're going to be happy about that. But also, like, it's a non-stigmatizing, non-judgmental space. And that's literally outside of the gym, outside of perhaps not even their own home, depending on what their environment at home is like. Perhaps it's the only other place where they get that. So, you know, to have that safe space is fantastic. They can go in there, be given their sharps, brown paper bag, whatever it is, walk out and... you know, move on. Now, there's been some criticisms in the literature around us moving beyond bloodborne virus prevention and safe injecting for iPad consumers. And I agree, you know, there's resources out, or I partially agree, there's resources out there, and a lot of them get this information through YouTube or forums or things like that. I think it's still a staple. I think it should always be delivered. I think intravenous and intramuscular injections, obviously different, and subcutaneous injection as well for iPad users. A lot of peptides and things are done subcutaneously, but that should be, you know, step one, right? That's the bottom line. A lot of them have commented that they want to move beyond, they want a little bit more than that. Like, they want some cycle advice or some advice around health management, you know, some advice around exactly what they're doing. And our workforce, at least in Australia, is still a little bit, I've run some trainings and things around the place, but I think we're still upskilling and trying to get ahead of that surge that we've seen in the last particularly 15 years, so closer to 20 now. And I think that part of that, you know, means peer workers, but peer workers that aren't financially invested necessarily, that are, you know, government funded. We have these for other substances, and peer and lived experience frameworks are taking off in, or they are gaining the recognition they deserve, particularly in Queensland. We have a lot of exciting work happening around them. I'm part of the peak advocacy body here in Queensland, QIVA, Queensland Injectors Voice for Advocacy in Action, on the board there. So big believer in leveraging the power of lived experience and peer work to move things like harm reduction forward. And part of that is, you know, yes, IV users, but also IM users. Intramuscular users or consumers. So having initiatives where, I mean, in Victoria, so down south towards the bottom of Australia, you want to imagine the map, we do have a steroid peer education program. We do have a worker there who is doing this type of work integrated with one of the NSPs there. Now, in Queensland, we still do not have this yet, although I've been actively pushing where I can. But I think it's not just here. This is, you know, something we need everywhere, and something that would be well received and protect against any sort of financial investment or things like that.
What haven't I asked yet that I should have?
I think the only other thing that springs to mind, like, immediately, and you like, I am a bit on the spot. There's probably a few things that I should mention, but really, it's that at least in Australia, we have a lot more women females turning towards these towards iPads and using them at a substantial rate. And if there was ever a less equipped, less prepared place to deliver harm reduction or policy, or a less known, recognized cohort, it's women who use iPads, I think, because not only do we know that substance use is gendered, and there's, you know, particular different dynamics that occur for IV consumption, it's even more true for IM consumption, because there's this double stigma effect, we'll call it, where not only are you injecting drugs and that's, you know, it's naughty, can't do that, you are also a woman who is going against the gendered beliefs and norms that you're meant to uphold in terms of femininity and things like that. So very, very powerful and effect that can stigmatize more. And so this drives women to, you know, again, even more taboo than men and other people speaking about their use. It is somewhere that we need to invest more in terms of educational resourcing, substance literacy. Like with IV use, you know, we see this partnership effect where women might actually turn to men, male coaches, boyfriends, partners, whoever it might be, for the information. And a lot of times, as I've spoken about, these are, you know, responsible people who are interested in harm reduction. However, they mightn't have all the appropriate information. And if there's somewhere where there's even less information about steroids and iPads, it's for women in terms of clinical literature. And so, you know, we're really drawing out long threads based on tiny, tiny bits of evidence. And so women might be getting the wrong information and therefore might be having an increased level of harm. Also, the psychosocial effects there. So, you know, might be some, and some of my participants have reported this, you know, a level of internal turmoil is the wrong word, but, you know, a bit of a challenge just navigating that very, very complex internal issue or challenge, there's feelings, things like that. I think that's a definitely a space where we need to, you know, rapidly try and step up and meet those needs. So whether that means substance literacy for women who use iPads, that's more accessible. I've toyed with that idea, but there's probably other things that could be done as well.
That was the second part of my conversation with Dr. Tim Piankowski, a lecturer and researcher at Griffith University in Queensland, Australia. You can hear part one on last week's show. For now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news
for the Drug Truth Network. This is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition.
So long.
The Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.